Welcome to Peter's Podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. On today's episode, I get to talk to Serge Cashman. Serge started practicing yoga by accident, bartering photography for yoga classes. His first teacher, Sabine Hoybusch, introduced him to Ishta Yoga. He completed a 200-hour training at Namaste Williamsburg with Debbie Desmond and later went on to the 500-hour Ishta teacher training, where I had him in my teacher training mentor group. He's influenced by Alan Finger and Sarah Finger, Douglas Stewart, and many others. As his interest over time shifted more toward meditative practice, he's also taken restorative training with Mona Anand and Gina Menza, and yin yoga and insight meditation with Sarah Powers. He's also Reiki certified. Serge recently opened Unit 108 Yoga, which is a studio in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. So I got to talk to him about philosophy, about teaching, about running a studio, and about what he's been doing and thinking about lately. Serge is an overall great guy. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, Serge.
Hi, Peter.
What were we just listening to?
Well, that was Wu-Tang Clan, as you can see probably on the up the stairs. You see the quote from that particular song.
Cool.
Which is like the world in the palm of your hand.
Uh-huh.
Which to me, it's kind of like a very tantric expression, because you know the palm of your hand is basically the expression of everything there is.
Shakti manifesting.
Yeah, so that's Wu-Tang, and as you know, they're from New York Staten Island.
Uh-huh.
So they're from around here.
Nice. Yeah,
and I thought it's relevant, like it would be relevant to you know, this entire mythology of liberation or whatnot.
Cool. I wanted to hear a little of that because I know it was a part of what brought you to New York in the first place.
Yeah, like hip hop. It was actually prior to Wu-Tang. You know, it was quite a long time ago. So back then it was, you know, like Public Enemy and things like that. And
uh-huh.
Wu-Tang was just like starting.
Right. And where were you hearing that?
Back in Israel, you know. Uh-huh. I'm originally from Russia, but I lived in Israel for a while. And when hip hop started happening, for us, it was just like kind of like an unheard of sound that, you know, it was really hard to figure out how it even happened. Like, and it was like extremely unusual and very interesting. And we were kind of into it. And back then it wasn't in the mainstream media, so you needed to know people, and it was still on like those cassette tapes and things like that.
Yeah. It was really rare to even know about it.
Yeah. So, but that's how I sort of got, interested in coming to New York, and not really like the United States, but like New York in particular.
Yeah.
Because like you did
it
get
is
a
its
sense.
Own country.
Right. You did get a sense that that's, you know, such a mix of, and you know, I come from a very multicultural background. You know,
uh-huh.
Israel is extremely multicultural too, but you know, compared to New York, there's nothing like it.
Uh-huh.
And being here just confirmed it. And in many ways.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you got here, did you pursue more of like being around hip hop?
No, not really. Cause I'm not a musician.
Uh-huh.
I was, you know, more into, first computer graphics and things like that. And then, like analog photography, like film photography.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still into film photography,
yeah,
as you know.
Yeah. Yeah. You use a lab in Bushwick, right?
No. Yeah. Bushwick is our competitor.
Okay.
Gowanus. Yeah. It's like right here, like 5 minutes on the bike. So.
Nice.
I mean, we're not really competitors. It's just there are only two photography, like two dark rooms left in the city that are open to the public. And it's like Gowanus and Bushwick Community
and you
dark
can
rooms.
Do developing and printing there?
Yeah.
In black and white and color, or just black and white?
In our lab, you can do color.
Wow.
If you know what you're doing.
Uh-huh.
I don't really know how to do analog color.
Right.
It's difficult. But yeah, there's a processor and there's like a separate area. We even have a safe Carlolite, which is extremely unusual. Mm. We just got it from the Long Island University down the road that recently got rid of all their darkroom equipment.
So. And for non-photo nerds, that means you have a light so you're not fumbling in the dark while you're working with color stuff?
Yeah, it's extremely unusual. Yeah. Normally, if you're working with color, you're just completely blind.
Yeah.
But there is some kind of like a rare, I don't even know what they're using, some kind of like rare mineral or something that, you know, you can actually have a light that doesn't affect color film.
Amazing. And somewhere in all of this, you got interested in yoga.
Yeah, actually, it was related to photography because I started working for, you're probably familiar, B&H Photography Store.
Yeah.
And it's an extremely physically exhausting, like retail in general, it's just like extremely exhausting and stressful job, and you're stuck in the same place for 10 hours, literally 10 hours a day with half an hour lunch break and, you know, 15 minutes break in the afternoon. So you end up being completely like, you don't even feel like a human being at the end of the day.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to explore, well, I don't like exercise. Like, I don't exercise.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted, but I felt like I needed to do something with my body and my mind after all of that.
Right.
And at some point I took pictures of a dance performance for, I think it was during Dumbo Art Festival, and I was shooting something for them. And then it turned out some dancers were not part of it. But, you know, they wanted to see the pictures of themselves.
Mm.
So we got in touch, and it turned out one of the girls is an Ishta teacher, like an Ishta trained teacher, Sabine Hoybush.
Oh, sure.
And we kind of bartered. So I shot their next performance in exchange for some yoga classes.
Ah.
And that's how I was introduced to, well, not directly to Ishta, because Ishta was part of Yoga Works at that point. But, you know, I went to Yoga Works eventually, and I've met you and Douglas, and there were some other Ishta teachers. Uh-huh. And at that point, Yoga Works classes were actually labeled as Ishta classes, if you remember.
I do remember that.
Yeah. So, and then later on, Ishta got separated, and you know, I kind of stayed in touch.
Yeah.
And I went there at some point, and I have like weird luck.
We had our place on Bergen Street then.
Before that.
Okay.
Yeah, like long before that, I went to like Ishta proper.
Yeah.
And I have a weird luck with meeting like yoga figures. You know, I've met Alan Finger in the line to the bathroom downstairs at Ishta. And, and like, I realized right away who he was, because like the way he talked to other people and it just like, it struck me that, okay, that must be the guy.
Yeah. That's great.
And weirdly enough, that was the same way I first met Dharma Midras, like, standing in line to the bathroom. It's like, oh, and he's like this short. He's like, oh, I can know this guy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So, So the bathroom lines were a great meeting place.
Yeah, exactly. at the yoga studio. You never know who you're going to meet.
Well, everyone's in a good mood then, you know, just to class. Cool.
And, you know, eventually, obviously, your place, the table, was not far from... I used to live next to the Navy Yard, and you were not that far away.
Right.
And somehow it worked out that your schedule exactly matched mine, and I took that bridge
right
program to sort of like, I already had that 200 hour
and certification. And where had you done your 200?
Unfortunately, that school doesn't exist anymore, and it was one of my favorite small schools. It used to be called Namaste Williamsburg Yoga and Tranquility Center.
Oh, nice.
And the girl named Debbie Desmond used to run it.
Uh-huh.
She doesn't teach yoga anymore. She's doing like she's capable of seeing people's auras.
Oh, yeah,
so she's
nice.
Doing like the aura reading thing now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it was a lovely place. You know, it was so nice. Just as far as like atmosphere and teachers, and you always had like tea at the end of the class, and it was just like they created like almost like an ashram over there.
Nice. Well, we're sitting in your yoga studio right now in unit 108, and have memories of that original place influenced how you set this up?
Yes, and also it generates a lot of anxiety too, because like obviously they were priced out eventually out of Williamsburg, and now like this neighborhood is up and coming too, not probably at the same pace, but
right,
yeah, but I try to make it feel more like a spiritual place rather than like a place to exercise,
right?
So that's why you see all those, you know, the books and incense and the singing bowls.
And the tea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
And you have this gorgeous
Tibetan,
yantra or
that's
Tibetan symbol?
Tibetan spelling of Om.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah.
That's why it's like reminiscent but different.
It is. Like the regular Om is on the other side.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And was that here when you took the studio over?
No, I stole it off of the internet and just drew it on the wall.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, it's really beautiful.
Yeah. You know, generally, if you look at the like the deities here, I think most of them are Hindu. And obviously, like the main one is Saraswati, which is like the goddess of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
But you also see Kali in front of the cemetery. There's a view on the cemetery, on a beautiful view of the crematorium. If you,
it is a very unique thing about your studio that it's across the street from the cemetery.
Yes, but on the other side, that there are like some Tibetan. Well, they're technically not deities, but in a way, Tibetans treat them even more godlike than the Hindu gods.
Called
Tibetan bodhisattvas, like Buddhist bodhisattvas, and Vajrayana Buddhism, they're like more gods than gods. You know?
Yeah. It's a level of development.
Well, I'm not that familiar with Buddhism, but like when you talk to people who are into that stuff, they're like, oh no, like when they give you a mantra, it's like, oh no, you cannot throw it away. You cannot, you need to treat it with respect. Like, you know, kind of like, you know, technically in Buddhism, there are no gods, right?
Yeah.
But they treat bodhisattvas with such respect that it's like almost more.
Well, my understanding is the bodhisattva is the person who has attained nirvana, but decides to come back and help others.
Yeah, kind of like Jivamukta in Hinduism.
Yeah.
So somebody, who doesn't have to stay here, but does.
Chooses to. Right.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
But, they have like the whole formal thing of like levels of heaven and stuff like that, and where they kind of arranged and the rule, it's I don't know that much about it, but it's very ritualized and very formalized.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, going to the Rubin Museum is a whole course in that, just walking around, seeing how many different expressions of all of that there are, historically speaking, because they've got so many depictions of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and sometimes if you talk to people who actually are from Buddhist countries, they have a very limited knowledge of all of that. I have a T-shirt that says Kanon on it, which is like the Japanese spelling of Guanyin.
Mm.
Guanyin or Kanon is like a bodhisattva of compassion. And in Tibetan Buddhism, it's like the main figure. And Tibetan is called Chenrezig. And Dalai Lama is like the representation of that.
Mm.
Like the earthly...
The incarnation.
Incarnation. So it's like a major thing. And I was talking to a Japanese friend of mine, and it took me a while to explain to her what it is. And I kind of even... I had that T-shirt almost by accident because it's the original name of Canon, the camera company.
Oh, the camera? Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's like... I made it as an inside joke, and nobody gets that inside joke.
You need to be a photographer and a Buddhist to get it. That's great. Let's talk a little about your studio project here. So you had the opportunity to take over a studio. It was already existent as a studio.
Yes, and I was teaching here like once or twice a week for about a year.
Because you live nearby here.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Like less than 10 blocks.
And we all know yoga is local.
Well,
there are certainly people who travel for yoga, but primarily I think it's the people who are in the neighborhood who find and love having a studio in their neighborhood, either by their work or by their home.
It's, not necessarily, because people do travel, even, to this studio, although it's probably not as much as like, Ishto or something, but you would be surprised. Like people come from like Bay Ridge and Chipset Bay. Interesting. Yeah. But yeah, it's mostly local people. But yeah, there were, when I moved into Sunset Park, there were no studios around. And then this studio opened up and a line opened up around the same time. And the line is about 10 blocks closer to Park Slope. So it's like more of a upscale area.
Mm-hmm.
And Sunset Park still didn't really have anything but this place. So they existed for almost 3 years, like 2.5 years. And then they gave up and decided to close. And they asked me if I wanted to take over. And my idea was, it looks like this definitely should be demand for a yoga studio in the neighborhood, and I should give it a try.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize how difficult that would be. Like if I knew how difficult that is, I probably wouldn't do it. But once you start and you learn things and you want to make this thing work.
Right.
And that's, I've been here for about 8 months, and it's sort of, it's getting more name recognition, and we're getting better at marketing, getting better at, like, it took me a while to just even figure out how to set up the signs and all the like regular logistics.
Mm-hmm.
Even appearing in on Google Maps, it took us like probably 4 months to be like solid on Google Maps.
Wow.
So it all takes time.
Right.
You know, I'm not sure if you tried to turn the table into like a full-time yoga studio, but it was kind of, you offered yoga classes.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So you know that it's not easy.
Right.
And small studios, it's hard for a small studio to survive.
Yeah.
Because of the rents and because of the scalability issues.
Right.
Because, you know, you really depend on attendance. You really don't. You know, if you're a large operation, you sell stuff online, you kind of have like, I don't know, like video subscription or something mm-hmm. like this. Like you have like other streams of revenue.
Right.
But for a small studio, it's so dependent on like day-to-day attendance.
Right.
That it's hard to survive.
Right.
Even
and I imagine it's a bit of a matter of... like the timeline and the overhead level, it has to be something that you can manage for long enough for it to catch on. And like you just said, the neighborhood is getting more popular. So being here theoretically would be a good thing because as people come, you're this yoga studio here. But you have to be able to maintain and
right.
sustain.
It's more difficult than this because... the original idea was to make it affordable for like the population that's already here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's mostly like immigrants, mostly Latino, and, you know, the Chinatown is not that far away. So
right.
It's mostly minorities and the affluent crowd is just moving in. So the original idea was to make it accessible to everybody. But I think in the end, you're right. It's basically, you know, the main audience for yoga classes are like the affluent middle and upper middle class people who are just moving in.
Right. And are you near Industry City here?
It's not close enough.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Industry City has their own stuff going mm-hmm. as far as yoga. They have like their own yoga studio for tenants.
Mm.
I don't think it's open to the public. But they do have free classes for the public,
mm-hmm.
which are pretty nice. I used to live right across the street from there, and I used to go every week.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty nice.
But they don't have the cemetery view.
They don't have the cemetery
view. Yeah. Very cool. So the kinds of classes that you're offering are a variety. You do some music things and some yoga things. And
It ended up being kind of really dependent on the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you look at our teachers, they're very, they come from very diverse background. And even from, not only from different schools, but like from schools in different countries.
Mm.
Like people who studied yoga in like Italy and Greece, Indonesia, and like, you know, like, things you normally don't really see in New York that often. So a lot of it depends on the teacher's ideas. And quite often, you know, I do have some ideas and I propose to try something and we try it, it doesn't work. And then the teachers want to try something different and we try something different and it does work. So it's... In a way, it evolves organically.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's what happened with music. Like one of the girls, she has a lot of musician friends and they wanted to try it out. So we did try it out and it worked. And then she left, but other teachers liked it. And
right.
kind of like was stuck with that. And it's really nice. It's quite popular, the live music classes.
Mm.
And we actually...
So when you do a live music class, how many musicians are playing?
It's usually just one.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a regular asana class along with that?
Yeah, sometimes they sort of, like when we had the sound bath thing, they really kind of planned it together, like our Isabel, our teacher, and the visiting Svetla, like the visiting sound healer, they kind of planned it out. So they each did their own thing in turns, and it worked out okay. The musicians, they usually improvise, and they sort of go along with the flow. And it's really, it's kind of amazing how it works out, because there is like this interaction between the mood in the room and the music that kind of like, in a way, it sets it, but then it also follows it. It's
response,
it's really
yeah.
like
a collaboration.
Collaboration.
Yeah.
And some of the musicians actually recorded it. Like some of it is even available for download, and teachers can use it for their own classes.
Mm.
It's very interesting.
Nice.
Yeah, it's. I'm not a musician, so it's really interesting to see it happen.
Uh-huh.
And a couple of guys that just use their computers, like they basically, they kind of. It's electronic music, but it doesn't sound like what you would expect electronic music to sound like.
Using samples and loops and things.
Yeah, it's samples and some like soundboards. I don't know what they are. Like, but it's a whole bunch of like gadgets attached to the computer, and they just like go along, and depending on what's happening, they just like do it.
Cool. And so, are those music classes something that occurs on a schedule, or are they just from time to time there's an event?
It depends on people's schedules, like the musicians' schedules.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to promote them when it happens. Right now, the idea is just to try and do it on a biweekly basis, but it didn't, like, usually it doesn't work out the way you want.
So that's the goal, but it's more individual than
like
that.
In August, it was happening pretty much every week. And then the last 3 weeks, we didn't have anybody. And we're going to restart it in a couple of weeks again.
Nice.
But, yeah, it really depends on who's available and who wants to participate.
So when those kinds of things come up, are you publicizing them in the web or in social media?
Social media, and we send out an email to, well, not to everybody, but to like a subset of people who we think might be interested.
Mm-hmm. People who have been here before who...
Yeah, and like to certain teachers, certain classes. We don't want to like bombard everybody our information.
Yeah. You were saying that before we got on the air, that there's this balance to strike when you're telling people stuff. I know I err on the low side. I almost never send anything out, except occasionally I'll put a social media thing. And then other times I'm receiving all this advertisement from someone or someplace. It is really striking a balance, because people do want to know.
Right.
But they're receiving a lot of information at the same time.
Yeah, a lot of it would be irrelevant to most people. So, and that's something I had to learn, and I'm still learning, the CRM systems, the customer retention management, they're quite advanced right now, because they are integrated with MindBody, the software that has like people's attendance.
Most people, if you're attending a yoga studio, most likely they're using MindBody to sign you in.
Yeah, but MindBody, you would be surprised. It's like the backbone of kind of like rules the fitness industry.
Mm-hmm.
There's like only one competitor that's like really not even close to them, and it's plugged into pretty much everything: the customer management, the Google ads and the Google Maps, and it's integrated with ClassPass and Fit Reserve, and what it's just like, there's a reason why they're being bought for like $2 billion recently. So, yeah, and so you need to learn how to work with that, and there are systems that kind of good enough at working with those databases to target people with relevant information.
So it helps people receive just what they're interested in.
Right.
Cool.
But it still, you need to be smart enough to set it up and also kind of know what you're doing. And I'm not there yet, but mm-hmm. I'm learning.
Mm-hmm. I mean, partly this whole venture is like such an adventure for something that you care about, right? It's like a project.
Yeah. It's probably the most difficult project I've ever attempted to manage. And you know, I do have some management background, and in my previous experience, the most difficult thing was to manage people and like to deal with people. And it turns out in the yoga studio, that's not the most difficult thing, because like people are generally, you know, teachers are generally well-meaning and positive, and they want to contribute. So, I don't know about other studios, but here we didn't run into much drama on that end.
Mm-hmm.
But what is really challenging is to make your project relevant for the people who it's for.
Right.
You know, and that's difficult, because you don't really know who they are and they don't really know what they need. And in a way, you want to maintain your own identity and let the people who it's relevant for to find you.
Right. Right. It's like meeting them halfway, because you want to be who you are, but you right. also need to respond to them.
Also, I don't know. I think Steve Jobs said it once, that people don't know what they want.
Right.
You know, it's very true. You know, if you look at the history of Apple, it's like you give them something that they, once they see it, once they experience it, they realize they need it.
Right, right.
And kind of like, I mean, yoga is also kind of like that.
Totally.
And I think you, at Ishta, when we discussed things about yoga, about teaching yoga, it was mentioned before. It's just like you bring people in for, basically they think it's for fitness or flexibility or something else, and then they discover there's like, oh, there's more to it. And,
right.
And they stick around for, you know, the peace of mind that it gives them, or
right.
whatever it is you offer.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so somehow or other, the marketing has to get them in the door to experience what they don't know they wanted.
Right.
Yeah. But I mean, now the nice thing is the yoga presence in America, or certainly in a metropolitan area, has risen to the level where most people have had some kind of exposure to it. And certainly there are many people who still think of it as a kind of a workout. And there are enough fusions of yoga. Like, interestingly, we started with hip hop. You know, there's like a studio down the street from Ishta that's a hip hop yoga. That's their whole thing, you know?
Yeah, I totally want to have like a Wu-Tang Namo class.
Imagine a paradise of palm trees, rice paddies, beautiful people, beautiful colors, wonderful weather in the middle of February, and yoga to boot. That's the retreat in Bali, February 2020, led by Aino Sirin and myself, with special guest Wendy Newton, February 8 through 15. Check out the show notes for a link, or see peterfurco.com for more information. Can't wait to go. Can't wait to see you there. Bali.
But then, you know, people do know that it's also about stress and about, you know, the whole vibe component of it. And so it's less of a hard sell, I think, when someone comes to yoga for the first time to know that that's going to be a component of it. Because when I took teacher training, there were, and some of this language still exists in our teacher training manual. It's as though you're going to have to convince people why it's a good thing to do meditation,
right,
or why they shouldn't try just to accomplish postures, you know, as though nobody's going to understand that anymore. But now so many people show up because they want that other component, you know. They already go to a gym. They already have some kind of workout. They do Pilates or something like that. So they're coming to yoga for the other stuff. So I feel like we're crossing into that territory where a lot of people already know that.
Yeah, that's true. I do get quite a lot of calls asking specifically for meditation classes. And right now we don't actually have like pure meditation classes. And that's something that's definitely, it's on my mind, but it's, we'll probably start with like seminars. We actually did have some seminars specifically for meditation.
Like a day long thing or a couple hours or what?
Like about 3 hours. And it went pretty well, but that's because the teacher had quite a bit of a following. So, and it wasn't like Ishta style meditation. It was quite, you know, pretty specifically Buddhist, which is quite different. Buddhist meditation is a bit easier to teach, I think. Like, it depends what you're doing, but like trying to get people into samadhi, it's more of a challenge than, you know, telling people to just watch their thoughts pass by and assign a label to it or something like this. You know. Because I know you wrote a book about kind of like, what's the name of it? Meditation Beyond Mindfulness?
Actually, our publisher is making us change the name.
Okay.
But that is still the topic. I mean, that is still the thrust of it.
Yeah, like mindfulness is easier to explain compared to like really try to get to a different, to like a level of stillness that you really kind of beyond thought.
Yeah. Well, it's a preliminary thing. You know, I think it's an appropriate kind of practice when one has never done anything like that before, you know?
Right.
And I mean, one of the things that I experience because I teach meditation all the time is you come up with a case, you know, you come up with a good explanation of what it is that we're doing. You come up with good metaphors for how this is like something that people already have experienced before. And so then they're at least game to try it. And then if you do a practice that's in the correct sequence, then it helps them get to that place where they will have, if not like this unbroken time of nothingness, they'll have some experience that they go, oh, that was pretty cool, I'd like to try that again, you know. And it's the in the continual doing of it that you get more from it, and so then it becomes self-fulfilling. But yeah, I mean, certainly it's easier to say, you know, watch your thoughts, what's your thought, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely something that we would need to introduce to the studio more often, because I kind of miss that about Ishta. And personally, I'm not like, I don't feel qualified to teach it myself, but it would be nice to have like a a charismatic meditation teacher around here
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that I found was useful and got students interested in it was saving 5 minutes at the end of class for doing 5 minutes of a meditation practice, you know, so that it they got this little taste of it, but it wasn't so hard to sit for. And it was really just when you've already done whatever you intended to do through asana practice, which leaves you pretty balanced and makes it easier to meditate. And then you meditate for, you know, 1-2 minutes of technique and 1 minute of nothing, and then shavasana.
Yeah, we do that. Like, I do that personally. And it does feel like, at least to me, I don't know what the students think about it, but like, at least to me, it feels like, well, that's kind of feels like a well-rounded yoga class.
Right.
You did a little bit of everything.
Right.
A little bit of pranayama, a little bit of meditation and shavasana. And then you sang om and like, oh, that feels like a yoga class.
Yeah, totally. And it is, because there are many yoga classes that don't have that.
Right? Right.
You walk in, you work on the hip joint, or you work on, you know, arm balancing or something like that. And it is just a physical practice with some focus attached, you know, some concentration built in, which is a perfect thing to learn from asana practice, how to concentrate.
Yeah. And that's something I actually miss a little bit myself, because I don't really have time to go to like challenging yoga classes, because I'm kind of stuck here most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I do miss like the one point in concentration of like a challenging class, you know, like if you go to like Dharma Meter or something,
right.
Because it's just like, it's difficult and you need to like constantly be on point.
Right, right.
So I missed a little bit of that, but yeah. But for most people, I think what we teach, like, because most people who live around here, they're not like advanced gymnasts.
Right.
Like, even like the regular asana class is pretty challenging.
Right.
Even like, I started doing like a simple thing, like close your eyes when you're in a tree pose.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you realize how much concentration is needed to just like stand on one leg with your eyes closed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, the thing is, if there's a student who, like you're describing, is not a gymnast, they never have done a yoga teacher training or anything like that, and they're coming in and they're goal is to get some of this whole of yoga, the whole thing, and they're working on any posture. If they can get that posture in whatever version they get, that's a really valuable thing, you know? And it's something that, you know, I always try to emphasize as a trainer of teachers, that it's so useful to take the judgment away from students, like their self-judgment, right? Like, oh, I'm not any good at this. Like, if you could try to stand on one foot with your eyes closed, just the trying is a tremendous practice, you know? It's not any less than what Dharma Mitra is doing.
Yeah, I'm always trying to find words for what you just said. It's not that easy. But I usually say something that, you know, like standing on one leg is a useless skill, unless you want to be a yoga teacher, you know. Even then.
Yeah.
But still, it's like the point of it is not to learn how to stand on one leg.
Right.
What are you going to use it for?
Right.
It's you know, that other component, the concentration and, you know, just being able to be sort of, and that's the point where you need to kind of come up with better words.
Yeah.
But But it depends on who's in front of you. Usually you can come
speak
up with something.
Them. Right, right. Exactly. You speak to the person who's in front of you in language right. they'll understand. Absolutely.
Yeah, because yeah. they could be like a school teacher or like a software developer or right. whatever, and you can come up with something to tell them.
Right. And that's what's so cool. If you get to know your students a bit, then you know who they are and what they do, and you can speak in their language. And that's so cool because, you know, a lot of times, like if you watch a TV show and there's a yoga teacher or something, they sound like, you know, spacey and this and that. And like, that's just going to either turn people off or not connect with them. But when you speak to a student in language they understand, then you can help them understand what is the purpose of this. Why are we standing on one leg? Why is this yoga doing this? You know what, and then you know in the back of your head, because you're a yogi and you've studied all this so deeply, that it's about concentration, and that every posture you do creates a shift in one's energy, and you're aiming to balance the energy so that you can be functioning in your optimal way, whether you want to then take that off into your day and not yell at somebody, or whether you're going to sit in meditation and gain what the bodhisattvas have, you know, and then bring that back into living. But you not everybody wants to hear a philosophical dissertation. So right. you just distill that down to a few words that make them want to try it, because it's when they do it, that's when they feel why you're doing it. Most of the podcasts I listen to stop right in the middle of really interesting conversations and tell me about watches, underwear, mattresses, food services, and even like odd things just like out of the blue that I can't even imagine why they're on. I'd rather not do that, so I've been trying to fund Peter's podcast with patreon.com. You can go to patreon.com/peterspodcast and subscribe by kicking me a buck, 10 bucks, 100 bucks, whatever makes sense to you. Please check it out and make this podcast commercial free. Thank you.
Yeah, and it sort of works. You know, like a lot of our regular students are school teachers, surprisingly.
Hmm.
I don't know why. It's just like there's something about this neighborhood. There's a lot of school teachers.
Hmm.
And so it's interesting to teach them, because they kind of used to explain to their student, why are you doing
right?
Well? And so, and then they come here and they're like adult people like ourselves, and you're kind of teaching them,
right.
them something, and you do need to kind of explain why you do that.
Right, right.
And like a short amount of time and limited words.
Yeah.
And I've been asked, like, how do you know all this? Like, well, I went to school for that.
There you go. Advanced studies in yoga. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And overall, you know, Ishta was a good school to go to, because it kind of does try to explain where the ideas come from, and the lineage, and the other thing that I like about Ishta is when L doesn't know something, he doesn't care to admit. It's like, you know, he's very straightforward about that. Like, you know, like he's not a researcher or something. It's
right,
just something
right.
that he learned from his you know, growing up with his father and his father's ashram.
Right.
It's not like he went and read a ton of books and,
right.
and learned from that. So,
yeah.
And if he doesn't know something, he just, you know, and he's open to other people's ideas if you
right.
think something different.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's this great line in the Bhagavad Gita about once you've done all of the experiences, when you have done your own yoga and you find yoga, all of the writings become irrelevant. right? It's like those were all to help you get to that experience, not the other way around.
Right.
So, yeah, interesting. So, so obviously your main yoga activity right now is keeping the studio running and figuring out how you're going to move ahead. Are you pursuing anything in yoga yourself in terms of reading or working on something or practicing?
I've been reading quite a lot, and I kind of realized that there's like chunks of information that are relevant to contemporary yoga practice that sort of escaped me throughout my teacher trainings.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've done a whole bunch of like different teacher trainings. So, you know, and I had to read a bunch of books and all of that. But like certain things I'm just starting to find out. Like I'm reading the Tantra Illuminated book that is extremely informative. Like I had
who's that by?
I would need to look it up. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
It's on my shelf. I can just
I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. It's extremely informative. Generally about like the influence of Shaivite Tantra on Hinduism and Buddhism, obviously, but also on Hatha Yoga. So basically Hatha Yoga is more or less like a direct descendant of that.
Right.
And it was like a whole bunch of different branches, and it didn't survive as a religion. It kind of existed as a religious movement at some point in the Middle Ages, but it by itself, it pretty much disappeared by the end of the 19th century. But it had such a tremendous impact on everything. So now whenever I see and I hear certain things in different traditions, I kind of like know where it comes from.
Yeah.
And certain other things, like things about like chakras and all of that. And it's like you ask people where did it come from, and like nobody knows. Like, oh, rishis 1,000 years ago meditated on mushrooms in the mountains and they came up with that. But actually it's more related to Shaivite Tantra traditions, like in the Middle Ages. And you know, so that's stuff that was basically almost unknown to me. And the other thing is like I didn't realize how influential all those like 60s and 70s people were, you know, Ram Dass and Bhagavan Dass, because I've heard about them, but I didn't know how influential they were on because yoga by that time was more or less accepted by the mainstream. It wasn't popular, but you know, it was in the 40s and the 50s, it was sort of accepted by the mainstream Western public, but then they made it cool for counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of like, and that in a way continues until today. So yoga has that countercultural aspect to it.
Right.
So I've been reading, you know, obviously, I haven't read the Be Here Now until now.
So now you can be here.
Yeah. And thankfully, Ram Dass is still alive. So have you read the New York Times interview with him?
No.
They had an interview with him recently. So it's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like that explains a lot. Like I didn't know how it came into being that you go to yoga class and you get like an entire, like from teachers who do talk about, like try to talk about philosophy and Dharma talks or whatever, you get like a mashup of like different religious ideas in one serving. And it's just like, where the hell? Because it's like, as if like all religions talk about the same thing.
Right.
And that's that idea comes from them, from like these, you know, the guys who try to figure out how to how to stay high as if you were on LSD without being high on LSD.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, that's a great place to leave this. So, thank you for having me in your studio. And for
thank you,
and for I hope chatting. I always enjoy catching up with you.
I hope some of it, I mean, at least some of it was meaningful.
Yeah, some
kind of just like
always. No, you're a very discerning yogi, and it's always refreshing to chat and see what you're thinking about.
Yeah, thank you. So, thank you for coming.
Yeah. All right. Namaste.
Namaste.
That's today's episode. Thanks a lot for listening to Peter's podcast. I hope that you find real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living through your practice. Please support me on Patreon, rate the podcast, and I'll see you next week. Namaste.